Okay, so welcome back. And so the last session is going to be, the last two speakers is actually going to be focused on applications of machine learning to kind of cutting edge areas in the sciences. So we'll hear about quantum mechanics and we'll hear about astrophysics. So our next speaker will be telling us about data-driven perspective on quantum physics of mini particles. And our next speaker is Giacomo Torlai from the Center for Computational Quantum Physics at the Flatiron Institute. This is this new institute in New York City that's focused on applying computation and data sciences, including machine learning, to different areas of science, including quantum physics. Giacomo got his PhD in physics from University of Waterloo and the Perimeter Institute. And he was really one of the earliest people in our subfield of quantum physics to apply machine learning tools to these problems where people weren't sure if these tools could even help you at all. Like, how would you even apply it? And he was kind of a pioneer in doing that. So, Giacomo.
Yeah, thanks for the introduction. And thanks for organizing this great event. I had the pleasure of talking to many of you yesterday and today, and it's been great. And so I hope you're having fun. And personally, I'm very thrilled to tell you this story about some of the recent developments between physics and machine learning. And in particular, as an application, I will tell you how to harness and how to use the speed of algorithms to tackle some complex problems in quantum many-body physics. And these problems, they involve quantum system, which comprise a large number of elementary constituents, right? And these elementary degrees of freedom interact with each other. So this could be particles, so like in Kiron's talk, there could be electrons in some molecules, or it could be a cloud of atoms, but there could also be some quantum bits in one of these quantum processors that they're building these days, right? So interaction, you could imagine, and some circuit running a specific algorithm. For the rest of the talk, I will focus on condensed matter physics. And condensed matter is itself a very broad field and studies quantum matters and materials. And I'd say one of the areas of particular interest and sees a lot of research efforts is the study of phases of matter, right? So liquid and gas, these are two examples. But there are many more. And some questions are, you know, under which condition a certain type of material can display a certain phase? What's the nature of the transition between two phases? And, you know, are there phases that do not occur naturally in materials, as far as we know, but we can engineer in the lab? And if so, what can we do with them? Are they useful for something? And I want to spend a few words on this. And I guess the starting point is this. This is a phase diagram of water. And I'm sure all of you thought this. And as in phase diagrams, we have parameters. And as we change these parameters, a material can behave differently. And here we have temperature and pressure. And at room temperature, water molecule in a liquid state, as we cool down the material at some critical temperature, it becomes energetically favorable for molecules to form bonds and crystallize in a solid state, right? This is a phase transition from liquid to solid. And this type of phase diagram is very common. But there are different type of phases, right? Depend on what you're looking for. And this is the special structure, but another example that we can experience every day are magnetic phases, right? And so if you consider the refrigerator magnet that you have, and this type of material, they are ferromagnetic, right? And what this means in a very, very cartoonish way is that all the magnetic dipoles in the atoms in your material, below a certain temperature, if this material is ferromagnetic, they want to align and point in the same direction. And this generates a macroscopic magnetic field. That's what, you know, allows you to stick the magnets in the fridge. And so what happens here if, what's the parameter, for example? And one thing you can do is you can start like raising the temperature and, you know, the thermal fluctuation, the effect of the heat is to start disaligning some of these spins, right? Or magnetic dipole, let's call them spins. And what happens is that when you cross a certain critical temperature, there is just too much thermal fluctuations, right? And at some point, there are just too much agitation, and the material demagnetizes. And so you shouldn't try this. I mean, if this critical temperature is very high, like hundreds of Kelvin, like maybe 1,000. But I was looking, and I found this material, this element, gadolinium, at a Curie temperature, that's a transition temperature, is room temperature. And you can find it on Amazon. I wanted to buy, but there was no Amazon Prime, so I couldn't get it in time. But I believe that this is should be a magnet, and you know, if you hold it in your hand long enough, it should demagnetize, so it's not radioactive or anything. So. And okay, so these are kind of conventional phases that we can experience, but there are an entire zoo of different phases of matter, and they can be bizarre and spooky, and this is what happens usually when quantum mechanics is involved. And to enter this regime, typically we have to lower the temperature when quantum mechanical effect becomes predominant. And one important example is superconductivity. And so this was discovered 100 years ago. And in some material like mercury or metals, so essentially we know that for these materials we just need to provide a little kick of energy, and electrons can leave the atoms and flow through the material, generating a current, right? And we all know that there is an intrinsic resistance, right? There are these tightly packed crystal of atoms. There are thermal fluctuation again. So as we provide some energy to this material in a form of an electric field, some of this energy is lost. There is dissipation, there is heating. And as we decrease the temperature, this resistance decreases as well, and at some critical temperature, it just drops to zero. And what happens is that there is a phase transition from a metallic state to a superconducting state. And in the superconducting state, electrons flow through the material without losing energy. And this is a big deal, right? You know, it has an important impact in our like everyday life, right? And so 100 years ago, there is a catch. And the catch is that the temperature where this happened is very, very low. It's 4 Kelvin, that's minus 270 Celsius. So we can realize this, but we just need to this very, very low temperature. So we need liquid helium typically to get to those temperatures, and higher is like very, very expensive. So we can't scale this to a real, to cool down power lines and something like that. This is not the end of the story though, and like 60 years later, around there, another type of superconductivity was discovered. This is referred to high temperature superconductivity. And the transition temperature where this type of material becomes superconductor is substantially higher. It's still low. We're talking about 100, 150 Kelvin, but it's substantially higher than conventional superconductors. And one important point is that the microscopic mechanism behind this type of superconductivity is different from conventional superconductor. Those we understand. The theory was formulated in the 50s, and we understand the mechanism. But the highest temperature is like something like 30 Kelvin, and this is a whole different type of physics. Okay. And this is one of the biggest unsolved challenge of condensed matter, because if we can solve this problem, then there is hope that we can find materials which can display superconductivity at room temperature. Okay. And one of the problems that prevent us to solve this problem is that the electrons in this material, they possess very strong interactions. And quite generally, when you're going to try to solve quantum mechanics for a large number of particles, you're going to find an intrinsic complexity just by having a large number of particles interacting. And when the interactions are strong, things get much, much worse. Right? When they are weakly interacting, you can circumvent this problem, and the interaction grows strong, you can find a way to overcome it, but that's one of the cases where we haven't found a way to solve this problem. And so at this point, I'd like to explain a little bit more in detail what I mean with this intrinsic complexity. And so what also Kieran refers to the many-body problem like we face in quantum many-body physics. And I think it's probably good to define a bit what a quantum state is, and I'll do it for the simplest possible case of one particle. And let's consider, let's stick to electrons, and let's strip away everything except the magnetic moment. So that's a very simplistic case, but it makes the point, right? So this object is quantum mechanical, and this property is quantized. That's an intrinsic property of particles, and electrons, they possess a spin, and the spin can be up or it can be down. Now, the question is, how do we characterize the state of an electron, right? And you know, when you enter the scale of atoms, particles, molecules, the microscopic scale, then physics is substantially different from what we are used to, right? From the physics that we experience in at the human scale. And one important property is that there is an intrinsic randomness when you look at the like matter and nature at this scale. So there is a, if we measure this property, if we take this electron and measure its spin, we're gonna find that the spin is pointing up with some probability and is pointing down with some other probability. And this is exactly an intrinsic uncertainty. It's not about ignorance. And I'll come back to that. And so the most general way to write down the state of an electron in this case is called a wave function. And the wave function, essentially, this is a most general form, and it tells you essentially everything that you need to know about this type of measurement. It's expressed as two different coefficients, one for the state up and one for the state down. And these coefficients are related to the probability that you would found that outcome if you measure, right? So those are the square. And this intrinsic uncertainty resides in this principle, which is called superposition. So the electron can be found in a superposition of these two states. And superposition itself is kind of a hard concept. We don't have any counterpart in the classical world. So I'll try to make an example to make it clear. Hopefully it will be clear, or I will confuse you more, we'll see. So let's consider equal amplitude superposition, right? That means that the electron is simultaneously in the state up and down with equal probability, 1/2, okay? And one way to think about this, because you know, what does it mean to be in the same state simultaneously, right? So imagine to imagine this state as two waves, two different frequencies, and then you can think about the wave function as the sum of these two waves. So if you look at this, you can see that the two states are simultaneously present in the wave function with equal probability. Right? This is a cartoonish way, definitely inaccurate, but the point is that you can have these two states at the same time. Now, we can see this in practice. In practice, what we actually see is a black box. We can look at the wave function. So what you can do at this point, you can ask a question. You can make a measurement. And when the state is in this superposition and you make a measurement, you can find one state. And this is what is, say, the collapse of the wave function without equal probability. And you can then find the other state with the same probability. But let me make a thing clear. There is no ignorance, as I said. This is intrinsic randomness. Because I hear sometimes, you know, if you only knew all the information about the state, then you could predict the outcome with certain probability. It's just that you miss information. That's not what happens, right? There are no hidden variables to be found. This is what was the critique from Einstein. There are no hidden variables to be found. There is nobody keeping track of the state of the electron. There is no record. The state hasn't been it's just been in this counterintuitive superposition. And so this is one important point about quantum states. And another consequence of the superposition is that if you want to write the wave function for one electron, you're going to need two different numbers, the amplitudes for the state up and the amplitude for the state down, because it can be found in this superposition. So if you want to store this state and somewhere on your computer and then retrieve it 1 year from now, you're going to need to insert two numbers just in a text file. Imagine something like that. And if you consider two electrons, what happens then? Well, two electrons, they have four possible states, right? Up, up, down, up, up, down, and down, down, right? But this is still a quantum mechanical object, so the wave function for the two electrons can be spread over all these four states simultaneously. So if we want to store this state, we're going to need to provide four numbers, or write down four numbers. What about three? Again, eight possible states, eight numbers. I guess you know where I'm going with this. If you keep increasing these n electrons, 2 to the n numbers. Now, that's a big number. And so essentially, you can imagine that if you want to store the wave function, you have this very long list of numbers that can be positive and negative. That can also be complex, but let's just keep it real. And so So TDN is big, but how big, right? Okay, I'll try to put things in perspective. Always helps me somehow. 40 electrons, that's, you know, that's not small, not definitely not big, but if I want to store a wave function for 40 electrons, I'm gonna need a 10 terabyte hard drive. Okay, well, you can get it, you can buy it, it's not super cheap, but that's fine. What about 56 electrons? Well, I'm gonna need to buy one of these big container, and I'm gonna have to fill it with 88,000 hard drive. I guess it's, you know, you can probably have some more cost-efficient way, but what about 70 electrons? 70 electrons, I believe this is the biggest ship container in the world, 21,000 containers, and again, you know where I'm going, 90 electrons, you have to line up 1 million ships. That's as much space as from the Earth to the Moon, full of containers, full of hard drives, full of numbers. 300 electrons is the number of atoms in the universe, 2 to the 10 to the 23 electrons, it's a mole, well, I don't know even what is that, right? So, I mean, what are we doing, right? What's going on? This is just definitely exploding, infinite complexity, okay? I didn't tell you the worst part. I didn't tell you how to find the wave function, and just if I give it to you, that's how hard it is to store it somewhere, but you have to find it first. And to do that, you have to solve the Schrodinger equation. And what is this essentially is, you know, you have a microscopic model, that's H, we call it the Hamiltonian, and this contains the property of the single particle and how these particles interact, okay? Those are the rule of the game, if you want. And you want to go from H to find a wave function. That's a state of this many particle system satisfying the rule of the macroscopic model. And this is it's also an exponential problem, okay? So since the formulation of quantum theory, this has been treated using calculus, and this works very well, also works perfectly if you don't have interaction, and works fairly well for weak interaction, but typically breaks down for strongly correlated system, that's what we call them. And so what we do at CCQ and in our institute is that we apply a computational approach, right? So what we do is we try to encode this problem in some computer code, and we run this code in this very large supercomputer, maybe for one day, sometimes for a month. A colleague of mine in Waterloo ran a code for almost 2 years. Then you're going to get a number, maybe more than one, and this is your answer, right? And so there are different ways to approach this, but there is a naive way, say, okay, well, I'll just do a brute force. I just take this microscopic model. I know how to solve it. This is just linear algebra, essentially. It's a fairly simple way. That's what Kieran was saying. We know how to solve this equation. And if you try doing so, well, that's me trying to do so, and I get to 16 electrons in this amount of time. If I get a bit more clever, I can get to 26. I think the record is 50, but not how this goes linearly, but then not the log scale, so this is exponential. So if you add one electron, then it becomes twice, you know, it's you can deal with that, right? So I'm just gonna flash now a few strategies that the community employ. That's one, that's DFT that we heard this morning. And a different strategy is using a compression. And essentially, the idea is that, well, we have 300 electrons and the wave function is as big as as many atoms in the universe. I mean, but then you look at the macroscopic physics and it's not, you know, it's like, it doesn't seem that complex. So maybe there is some redundancy. Maybe quantum states, you don't need that many number to treat them. And you know, this is indeed the case in many situations. And you can compress this quantum state from this exponential mass to something which is, you know, polynomial, say. And this is what Miles is an expert in. And it is a fully quantum problem, right? There is other approaches, and one say, well, I have this quantum system, maybe two electrons moving, and I have this exponential scaling, and I can't treat it. But then you think, well, if the system were classical, the system was classical, I know how to solve that. I know I have this powerful algorithm, but then when it becomes quantum mechanical, this breaks down. So maybe I can find a way to transform this problem into something which is classical, and then solve that problem. And you can do this, I know it sounds funny, but you add an extra dimension and these quantum particles become like strings in this higher dimensional space and you can solve for this problem. Now both the compression technique and mapping to a classical system, as well as the FE and many other, they have their strength and they have their limitation. And for example, this ITC, superconductivity, is one of the cases where none of this technique can reliably find a solution to the microscopic problem. And of course, there are other paths, and one was suggested by Feynman, say, well, naturally it's quantum mechanical, use quantum mechanics to solve it. And so we heard before too, what you can do is that you try to solve some real quantum matter and you use a quantum computer to do so. And this is a simulation that I ran in one of these small quantum computers, simulation of magnetism. And this is the real solution, the one, it's not nothing unsolved, I knew what the answer was. And this is the solution that I got using this quantum computer with three different type of simulations. So it kind of works at the beginning, but then as it starts going bad, and this is because, as we were saying before, these devices are noisy. You don't have error correction. And we do have error correction in classical computer, and it works very well, but this is not, we are not yet there. So there are things you can do with these devices, but we can use it for like large-scale quantum simulation just yet. And these are like 5 qubits. It's not really large scale after all. Another paradigm, which is I'm more interested in, and this is more related to machine learning, is what I would say quantum emulation. That is, well, I have this real quantum material, I can solve it, and I have limited control on the type of measurement I can do in it. Maybe I can find some synthetic material that I can build in the lab, which has the same microscopic physics, right? But I can control, I have a high degree of control in it, so I can perform very specialized measurement, and I can tweak, and I have all these knobs, and I can explore regimes where maybe they're not accessible in the real material. And the point is that by doing so it's like you're not solving the Schrödinger equation. Essentially, you're asking this to solve it for you. You're asking nature to solve the Schrödinger equation. You don't want to calculate psi, the wave function. You just let it solve itself. And then, well, then the problem doesn't just disappear, right? Yeah, then you have to find a way to extract it. Yeah. So this means doing some measurement. And measurements means having data. And so the problem now, it's just being rephrased, doesn't disappear. Now we have to find a way to extract physics from data. So that's where all this machine learning and quantum manipulative physics, they come together. And so let me tell you a little bit about that. Physics from data, such a good news, right? Well, I mean, people have been doing that for a long time, I'd say. Like, yes?
Can I just ask, so are you talking about like cold atoms?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I will go a little bit in detail, like a few slides. Yeah. So data-driven physics. I'll forget the quantum for a moment. New thing? No. Well, look at this guy, Tycho Brahe. He was like 1500, and he sat down and he looked at the stars for a long time, and he filled on this table: position of the planets, position of the stars. Okay. And these are called rule of fine tables, I believe. And this data led to the Kepler laws. So Kepler finished this table and he was looking at it and he found patterns in this data. And he came up with the Kepler's law by that. So that's impressive, right? 500 years ago. Other example, well, there was data that there was, let's say, a part of the puzzle that led to a formulation of quantum theory. And in particular, this gentleman, Rutherford, he proposed a model of atom which had a massive nucleus and the electrons were orbiting around, okay? And this model had some problems, and one of the problems is that the electromagnetic radiation emitted by the atom, if you consider this matter, should be continuous. These are the frequency that are the light emitted by the atoms. But when you do an experiment and you look at it, you find something like that, okay? There are specific line, a specific frequency. So something is wrong, right? And so some people, Balmer, Lehmann, and Rydberg also, I think, they found a way to predict the position of this line very, very accurately, doing some empiric formula. And this then suggested that indeed the structure of the atoms is something more like that, right? There are discrete energy levels, and then this line, they correspond to transition of electrons from one level to another. So that's why they are discrete and they can only assume certain values. So let's fast forward to today. Okay, so this is something like this highly controlled experiment. I thought it was some kind of storage at first. I couldn't believe it, but then now this is the real deal. And I was at the time in Munich, where most of these experiments were done, and I visited these labs, and I was amazed by what we could do, what we could achieve, and what they could do. They could cool down clouds of atoms and achieve essentially single atom control. So you can see here, these are atoms, like laser cool atoms, okay? And those are very sophisticated experiments. And well, you can do more than that. You can actually draw things. So these are single atoms, believe it or not, and I could not at first say, wow, like this is impressive. They can actually not only measure but control the single atom. And this, you know, this provides very, very exciting possibility, because you can probe quantum mechanics at its core, right? And so this is the data that I'm referring to, right? This is the quantum data. And clearly here, there is nothing very deep going on. Here people, they just arrange this atom in some periodic structure. But then you could say, well, I can engineer this syntactic quantum matter in this lab, which maybe emulates some other material I'm interested, or maybe just for the sake of exploring. And then I can make these very refined measurements, and this measurement will give me an insight on the physics, right? If I'm looking for a wave function, that's where I'm going to find it. And so it's not going to be something like that. It's going to be me something like this. This is a simulation I ran the other day. It's, you have spins, and they have the single state, and Kiran said these are like highly entangled state, and this thing fluctuates, as this is related to one of these topological phases of matter, which is like very exotic and interacting, strongly interacting. And what we can do really with what Tycho Brahe did, right? I can highball this and hopefully to find a wave function. But it's there, right? It's just hidden in some non-trivial way in this data. So that's what I mean when the problem is offloaded. Now, this I simulated because I knew how to, but imagine going into a lab, doing a measurement, getting something like this, and all everything is encoded inside this data. And so, well, you know, are we equipped to extract this information? That's the question, right? And that's where machine learning comes into play. And I mean, we heard in the previous talk a very good explanation of what's going on. And I'm gonna walk through a couple of applications, if I think I can with time, of that's very recent works on how we can obtain some information that was previously not available using machine learning. Okay. So the first question is, can we validate or reject theories from measurement data? Okay? And this is related to this high temperature superconductivity. So this is a bit the physics part, and I'll just briefly describe it. And this is again, this is a platform that allows you to probe this type of physics. Now they can reach temperature like low enough to enter in the superconducting state, but they're getting closer. And so the idea is that, okay, we have the electrons in this, they're called cuprates material. Those are like these crystals, and they have this high temperature superconductivity. And then we want to do something which mimics this physics. So first we need the crystal. And these are called optical lattice, this crystal of light. So they shine two counter-propagating laser beams. There is an interference, a static pattern appears. And so essentially these are like patterns which mimics the potential, the electrons fields inside crystals, okay? So you don't want to use electrons, you want to use atoms, you have more control over them. And so what they do is that they load this mixture of lithium atoms, two different states for these atoms, one for spin up and spin down, and they load these atoms into this lattice. So the idea is that they are trapped into two dimension, and those they should behave like electrons in this lattice. So as the same way as electrons, these atoms can move around, they have kinetic energy. And the same way as electrons, these atoms interact, they are charged as charged particles, so you have Coulomb interaction. But because electrons obey Pauli exclusion principle, this a situation where two atoms with the same spin are in the same position, that's forbidden. So that's why they use lithium atoms, because those are fermions, and fermions obey these statistics. And so you do this, you see this is kind of the, how the experiment works. You have this 2D, you have these two type of atoms moving around, and then they can record images, and then you get something like that. So these are the atoms, right? This is just a grid, but this is the real picture of what's going on there. And this is the data that we want to use, well, to essentially understand the physics, okay? And so this is a problem that we are not able to solve using any of the techniques that I said before. In a particular regime, there are no algorithms that allow us to understand this physics in a reliable way. However, you know, there are still like many theories that have been proposed to explain this phenomena. And so imagine having two theories, okay? And so these two theories, and don't mind what they are. They are two different theories. The goal is to explain the physics that they realize in this platform. And using these two theories, you can generate images, such as like this, right? And they're gonna be different. This is just a cartoon picture, okay? And so we have two images. They have belong to two different theories, and we have seen this before, right? That's the same thing of cats and dogs, okay? So the question is, can we build and train a neural network which is able to distinguish images from these two theories? And the images are just where the atoms are. That's very simple, okay? So we can use a neural network, and as before, we have an input layer, and these are gonna be each, say, position in this grid, and say one if there is atom, and zero if there are no atoms. Then we have some more or less complicated network with some weights that we're gonna adjust. And we're gonna have two outputs. I mean, I could have had one because it's like a binary, but you know, we're gonna have two. It's like a bit more parameters here. I haven't done this. This is an experiment that it's not been done in our group, but they used two. And essentially this tells you what's the probability that some image here belongs to theory one, and what's the probability that belongs to theory two. Okay, and we know these are probability, they sums to one. So that's essentially the same strategy that we've seen before for the rectangles and the strategy that we've seen for the natural images, okay? And so ideally what we want is that we feed an image of theory one, we propagate the signal, and then we get some confidence, say 96%, then this image was produced using theory one. And we can do the other way around, and we need the good confidence that this neuron lights up, okay? And so this is done by training the network. I don't want to go into detail, but I just tell you once again the kind of the philosophy. And the point is we want to find a set of weights which realize these two conditions that I showed before. And as you initialize this network and you propagate the signal, you're going to get something like that, something like, you know, half and half or something which is wrong. And you know, this is the right answer. So what you wanna do, you wanna take these weights and change them by using this calculus rule so that at the next iteration, this number increase, okay? And you do it again and again, okay? And suppose that you succeed in this task and then you got a network that can reliably distinguish these two theories. Now what you can do is that you can feed the experimental data, okay? And you can ask, well, what's the theory of this data, okay? Is it theory one or theory two? Okay, that's what they did in this, that's very recent, it's a few months ago. And these are the results. This is one of these parameters that you tune in this phase diagram. Essentially, when we are here, we have, in average, one atom per this grid point. And when we move away, we are essentially removing atoms. And here we can understand what's going on, and as you move there, all this kind of simulation that we do breaks down. And this is the regime where the material becomes superconductive. It needs a lower temperature, so we are not crossing this boundary with the superconductivity, but that's the regime that we can solve. And so what the network does, it tells that, you know, in this low doping regime, the theory one, the geometric things, I don't mind this too much, explains the data, but and theory two less, and this seems to cross, although there is not very much confidence there, okay? And so why does this provide more information than previous attempt? And the point is that they were done, you know, you could do the same without a neural network. You could find some way to probe this, right? Maybe you want to compare some measurement that you did, but then by doing so, you're introducing bias. You're saying, are these data from this theory according to my metric? And if we don't fully understand what's the correct metric to use, so we're gonna get something which is unreliable. And in fact, using the metrics, for example, correlation function, they weren't able to distinguish with good certainty which theory was explaining the data, but this seems to provide like at least a more confident answer, which is great. And okay, so you can build a classifier essentially to distinguish between two different theories, but then we can go a little bit farther, right? And we say, well, can we use the neural network not to tell which theory the data resembles more, but to tell me directly the quantum state of the data? Okay, that's what I've been working on in particular. And in the, rephrasing the previous talk, what Yasmin was saying is the one that I just showed you, supervised learning. You have data, the images of the atoms, and you have labels, the theory. I want to do unsupervised learning. I don't care about the label. I don't have the theories anymore. I just show the data and I want to understand the structure of the data, which is the wave function, okay? So that's what we had before. We had some experimental wave function, which we don't know, but it's there by name. So that's what the state of the plot, the simulator is. And we do measurements and then we feed to the network and it tells which theory is more likely. Now we want to do something different. We want to have the same process here, feed to the data, and tell us the wave function. And the wave function can be related to the probability distribution on this input layer. So instead of saying, what's the probability of this theory given an image, I want to know what's the probability of the image. And so maybe this connection is not obvious. There is much more to be said, but remember what I said in the previous slides, that the probability of measuring some state was the square of the coefficient of the wave function, right? And so this is what I want to measure here. If I have access to the distribution, then I get access to this coefficient. So I'm learning the wave function. So there is a catch, that is I'm doing a square here. So it's a bit more involved, but we can distinguish even like positive and negative coefficient. It's just a bit more more complicated, but say, you know, this is kind of the philosophy behind, right? We can relate this coefficient to the probability distribution of the data, but we can learn this probability distribution. That's what this neural network do using unsupervised learning. Okay, and I'm going to show you an example. Now we are actively working with experiments. This is a work in progress, so I don't have like results to show for that, but I can show you something that we calculated last year, and this is all synthetic data, meaning that that was us that generated the data in the first place using the computer. It's just like a feedback that we generate the data, so we generate the wave function, we do the measurement, so we simulate the measurement process, then we reconstruct the wave function and we compare back, right? That's what you do when you invent you develop a new algorithm, you check its validity in some known cases. And so this is a wave function for 12 electrons. And now I'm going to explain what this is. 12, 2 to the 12, 4,000 coefficients, right? From here to there. Remember the big vector? Okay, so it doesn't fit 4,000, okay? So I plot it in this way. I know it can be confusing. These are not the position of the atoms anymore. This is the wave function, okay? This is what it is. You start from here and you say, well, I have a grid. This is coefficient 1. This is coefficient 2, 3. You see there are 8 times 8, 64 squared, 40,000. Okay, and the color is what's the value of the coefficient. let that sink in for like a minute. So that's a way to visualize the wave function. And you know, 12 electrons, it's a bit underwhelming. I've been telling you, you know, we can do it like exactly. Yes, but again, we went up to 150, which depends who you ask. If you ask me, that's large, but not depends again who you ask. But this is just, you know, to show you how this can how this works. And so this is the wave function for all the possible states of this electron system, and then we perform measurements on it. I don't have the measurements here, but those are just one and zero, like bit of strings of bit of one and zero, and you have 12 of them, and one measure, two measure, thousand measure, etc. You feed this to a neural network, you apply this algorithm, and you ask what's the wave function from the data, and this is the result. Okay? Did I just copy paste this here? can you spot some difference? There are. If you look close enough. So yeah, this is almost closed. Here is open. Okay, so it's true. Okay. So the neural network is the wave function here, essentially, and this is also connected to this compression mechanism, because what you've done, you've done two things. You haven't solved the Schrödinger equation. We did in the first place. But imagine you have an experiment. You let that solve, then you extract the wave function using machine learning, this unsupervised learning. And on top of it, you use a neural network as a compression technique, because now we don't have 2 to the n parameters anymore, but we have as many weights in the network. That's where the wave function is encoded. So I could have just plot the same square, but just the value of the parameters, and that would, you know, encode the same information. It would be the same. So I guess that's kind of the philosophy behind this. Okay, so I'm gonna conclude. I would say there are a lot of interesting problems in condensed matter. I just talked a little bit about superconductivity, but there are many more exotic phases of matter that we don't understand, and a neural network here can really play an important role to, from a phenomenological perspective, they can allow us to explore this regime of physics that we don't fully understand yet, and we can harness this data that is available today, and this is becoming a reality. And 10 years ago, we didn't possess this high-quality data, but now we do. I'm going to have more and more data. So I envision there could be a shift in the paradigm that we do science, because we have this data, and we should make good use of it. But this is not the end of the story. There is much more. Surely this is an application, but now we have all this new quantum processor and quantum hardware, and neural network can provide a sort of analytics, right? I have this chip, and it's doing something quantum. How do I know, right? So maybe I can run an algorithm. I know what's a state that need to produce, and then I can use neural networks to just see that the state that is generated is the correct one, to just see what is going on here. And ultimately, we have also been working on applying this neural network to perform quantum error correction. That's what is going to make quantum computers, say, useful, I guess, in the long term. Not the neural network we make, that quantum correction is its own field, and there are many, many different techniques. That's just the last two in the toolbox. But this is still a bit down the road, but you know, that's another type of application where you can use data to do physics. And I think I conclude right here. Thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot, Giacomo, for a really clear talk. Can we have a question over here?
This is a simple question for me. Is there quantum computers? Do we really have one here? I mean, not here, but...
Well, funny you say, because actually in Santa Barbara, they're building one, and that's from the Google team. So there are, there are quantum computers, and I forget to thank you for the question because I wanted to say, but I forgot. There is this thing called IBM Q Experience, and I suggest you all to go and check it out. Then you can make an account, and you can literally run your algorithm on a real quantum computer. I'm not kidding. Yeah, this is IBM Q Experience. You can run it for as long as you want, of course. You have tokens, and you can just build some simple algorithm, design a circuit, and just play around with it. And that's the service that I use to do that little simulation that I showed you in the talk. I just register, I use some token, I draw a circuit, and I simulate like a small quantum magnet using the circuit. Clearly, the simulation degrades pretty, pretty quickly, but it was still very interesting to do that. I guess it's here. Yeah, so that was the chip that I use. The 5 qubit. Yeah, the talk is 170 megabytes, so every time I go from one to the other. 5 qubits, yeah. I simulated 5 quantum spins interacting, and this is the result. But again, it's noisy, so you can run a very long algorithm. It's pretty cool, right? Yes?
If you can go back to the second, it's a very naive question, just for me to get clarity. If you can go back to the second last slide that you showed with the actual wave function on the left,
right.
And then the neural wave function.
Mm-hmm.
So, so the wave function on the left, that is really a photograph that was made from the lithium atoms?
No. So this is, sorry, maybe I should have made that clear.
There any connection between the instrument you had there and the lithium atoms?
No, the lithium atoms was the previous experiment. And that's what I was for the supervised learning part. And this is just 12 electrons, and that's just a simulated data. So. It was really electrons, more like a quantum spins, and which has same property, but I didn't have Pauli exclusion principle there. They were in different space, and they weren't moving like a spin chain, and this was like a time evolution of the spin chain, and this was after some time that the system was evolved, and it took the wave function there, but it's not related to the lithium atoms, no, yeah. Just synthetic experiments we did.
More questions?
Yeah. So I wanted to ask a question about bias. In the example that you gave, it's clear that the wave functions are only up down. But in the case where you don't know what your solution might look like, how do you know that you're not introducing bias? Because if you put in Gaussians, then you're going to get out Gaussians. It's like the classic, you're looking for hammers, mm-hmm. You know.
Oh, that's a very good question. Thanks. Yeah, so that's true. But that's why we're physicists too, right? We have some insights on what the physics is, and we are not just saying like, okay, this is an algorithm and it's just going to look for all possible solutions. We input some knowledge that we have on the physics that we want to explore. And so, yes, that in some sense that introduces bias, but we always hope it's the good kind of bias.
Just had a clarification question. Mm-hmm. So you created a reliable neural network to which you can feed a wave function, and it will tell you what the wave function is. So how are you going to use that? So you would actually... Am I mixing up stuff? So you can take the picture from the lithium ion experiment and feed it into this neural network. Is that what you want to do at the end?
Yes, and that's what we are currently doing, not for the lithium, for another experiments. But yeah, so we feed the measurement of the single atoms. So that's not the wave function directly, but the wave function is some hidden structure underlying this data. And we use the neural network to extract this wave function, and there are many reasons why we want to do that, and And one just on top of my head is that we can measure things that are not accessible in the laboratory, say. Like quantum entanglement is one example. That's a very, very hard thing to measure in the lab. It's a very non-local property. Has been measured in an experiment. It was like very, very feet of strength. It was like very complicated, and it's not possible to scale to a large system. So, but if you know the wave function, then you can compute things such as entanglement, for example. So that's one reason to extract information that are not accessible in the original experiment.
Jacqueline, I think one of the last calculations you showed, you were pretty proud of the fact you did 150 electrons.
Yeah, they were like quantum spins.
Spins. And you got the wave function, right?
Yes.
So where did you put it?
In a neural network. It was...
But wasn't that the thing that needed...
It's essentially, I have to wait a moment. It's essentially what happened here. So it was an Ising model. It was like a simple quantum spin system. And we performed measurement of the direction of the spins, creating a data set. And then we trained the neural network and doing unsupervised learning. And by the end of the training, the neural network itself was the wave function.
But I thought like 2 to the 150 required all the shipping containers.
Yeah, it does. It does. But we don't store the full state.
Ah, that's what I'm asking.
No, yeah. Here it was just a demonstration. So
this is 12.
Let me say. This is a demonstration just to show.
Yeah.
But the principle is the same. Even in this case, I just printed the full wave function, but I never store it in full. It's always compressed in the neural network parameters. Right, and maybe I'm explaining.
You can produce any of those 2 to the n numbers you want. Like if you challenge them.
Well, that's what I'm.
Yeah.
I can
compute the wave function for any of those states, because I have an explicit representation.
Yes.
So I can always do a big loop, and ask the neural network to tell me what's the wave function for each state, and here I did the same, and I finish all the state in a reasonable time, but I cannot do it for the 150 spins. So, in that case, I can produce the wave function, but I can produce observables, say.
Right.
Like
measurements. Okay. So, in principle, if you sort of waited long enough and computed long enough, you could list out all the numbers.
For sure.
They are all there, but you're not printing them out. Yeah.
Yes. I still don't know the normalization of this distribution. So I could compute the unnormalized wave function, say.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah, I actually had a question, which was, so it seems like there is a little bit of a knot to cut here, which is that you have a scaling problem where you can only simulate up to a certain size, and that would be how you would get the data to train in the first place.
Yes.
So then if you go carry it over to, if the purpose is to go over and carry to an experiment that's bigger than you could even simulate on the computer to see what it's doing, but how would you get the data? Or if it was data for a thing where you could scale, then why do you need the experiment?
Well, no, the experiment can always generate the data, right?
Yeah, that part, definitely.
So even if it's a larger system than what you can simulate in the first place, I mean, that's a ghastly point.
Mm-hmm.
That's maybe I should have made this clear, is that we want to be in the regime where we cannot generate the data ourselves. We want to be in the regime that the experiment can realize that, can find this wave function because they have this platform, and we can use this technique to extract this wave function from the data. And that's a regime that they can always generate data. You can always, mm-hmm. always, if you have like the...
You can always measure the experiment.
You can always measure, because what we use are very simple, like just mm-hmm. occupation number or spin magnetization. This is always thing that when you have this single atom control,
mm-hmm.
that you can achieve, right? And yes, I would say, yeah.
Oh, I see. So this unsupervised one, you don't need the training data, right? Like, I mean, you don't need the synthetic training data. I mean, for the test you did, but from the experiment, you could just do it straight away, I guess, right?
For the experiment, yeah, that's what we are doing right now. They run an experiment, and they it's a different type of platform. It's not lithium atom, but rubidium atoms. They are trapped with optical tweezers, and they can measure if they're in excited state mm-hmm. or ground state.
Mm-hmm.
They gave us the data, and we found the wave function.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Okay, we still have a little bit of time for more questions, if there are any.
What is What do the waveforms make that pattern of reducing squares? Is it something about the lithium itself?
Or excuse me, can
why do they make those patterns? The squares?
Yeah, that's a good question. This is like a, it's just the way that I plotted it. It was totally accidental. So it's just that there is, so this is, that's a good question because by you can see the structure that is in the wave function. And it makes this square just because I think, you know, by chance, this wave function has this structure particularly. But that's one of the points I was saying, that you don't need this like exponentially large number of parameters because you exploit some structure that is present. And this structure, you can clearly see it here. Yeah.
Was it a ferromagnet?
This was for the expert here, this was like a quantum quench, the time evolution of long-range quantum ferromagnet. Yeah.
I thought I saw some ferromagnetic points. Yeah. Great. Okay, one more question, or one or two more questions.
It seemed from the graph where you had the two theories and you had the assignment using the neural network, and then there came the point where it really wasn't sure, it didn't have a lot of confidence. So is that saying, it would a reasonable conclusion be neither one is really explaining what's going on? And then if that's the case, would this unsupervised learning be able to provide you with some new theory that you could then go test, or are you kind of back to the drawing board with like what's really going on?
Yeah, that's a great point. So this is exactly that. So this tells you that the network associates a higher probability to this theory, but they're very close to each other. So in this regime, you cannot definitively tell which one is correct. But if you ran unsupervised learning on this data, which we did not, and neither did they, but I hope this is going to be the case soon enough, then again, you could, instead of just validating a theory, you could extract the wave function of that, of the data, right? So, and of course, it carries all experimental imperfections, and you need to take that into account. You know, your reconstruction can only be as good as the data. So, but yeah, that's a very good point.
Okay, one more question.
Great. Maybe it was more than that. Forward. Yeah, right here. So on this one, the different colors, what are those? I know you said that those represented in terms of a certain number, mm-hmm. and I'm assuming you chose the scale in terms of like if yellow meant a certain number, red a certain number, you know, hot, cold, whatever. Could you just kind of, I'm just thinking, kind of relating back to some of the coding we talked about this morning, and to realize that with a picture you can represent 4,096 different coefficients, and that you've got the color that represent. I think from what you said that the color goes with the number for the coefficient. Is that what you said?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, that's true. But maybe I should have been more clear about this. This is not the type of data that we feed into the network. This is the wave function, and we feed measurements perform on this type of wave function, but if you, I don't
sure.
Yeah, there are coefficients, but this is, maybe I didn't understand the question correctly, but if you meant that we, these are the type of, like the pixel in the image that we feed, no, it wasn't that.
It's taking the data to produce the pixel.
Yes, it's taking the data to reconstruct these colors, essentially. Yeah, so in this case, actually, those numbers go from 0 to 2 pi. They're like a kind of, that's all, it's just like a color map, essentially. Yeah, and then you have like free to choose that. Yeah.
Okay,
kind of like these are like the probabilities to generate different data that you would feed in, right? Like the colors would be like places you'd generate
those are,
different kinds of pictures from.
Yeah, essentially, yeah.
Correct? Yeah. Okay, thanks for all the great questions. That's really
awesome.
Great. Yeah, thanks a lot.
Somewhere near your collar. too.
Yeah, that was great. Okay. I'm 62%, so should be fine. Thanks.
Try to put on. Yeah, try to just flip the clip.
Yeah.
Hi, my name is Sherry Harper, and I work with this group called the Contemporary Physics Education Project, and we basically do lessons and posters and so on with some contemporary topics in physics. And we have a teacher's contest for people who do some of these topics, like nuclear physics and particle physics and so on, in their classroom. And there are a few papers out when you're dropping off your... when you're dropping off your survey.
Yeah.
And also, I believe they tweeted an announcement about it. The deadline for it, unfortunately, is March 1st, so it's coming up. But there is a small monetary prize along with some of our materials from the Contemporary Physics Education Project. So if anybody's interested, if you want to go to our website, it's www.cpepphysics.org. And there's information about it on there also. So cpephysics.org. And there's some information regarding that.